Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for November 8th. Welcome, Catherine.
Hello, everyone.
And welcome, Tim.
Good evening.
Yes. Well, I want to tell y'all, I've been down at the Georgia Dome, and I'm not going to bore y'all with a bunch of football talk, but I want to tell you that typically everybody accuses all over the country of sending their best blowhards to Washington. Well, I tell you what, I sat directly in front of three that they sent back to Georgia. The most three annoying people I've ever sat near at a football game. So I guess, you know, anytime anybody complains about what we send to Washington, they got us back today. Hopefully they'll go back to Northern Virginia, Southern Maryland, or the District of Columbia, wherever they came from. But nevertheless, we're going to talk about tonight. We have got post-election wrap-up for statewide and municipal races, pretty much in the South, but even in other places, because there were two other races outside, or actually three others, that are pertinent to what's going on. Also, Billy Mitchell, former Mayor Pro Tem, City Council member, and current state representative, is going to be our special guest. Probably get Billy to talk a little politics, too, but he's going to talk about the recent 30 Rock episodes, which one was set in Stone Mountain, and they've gotten where they pretty much mention Stone Mountain all the time. So we're going to have a little fun with Representative Mitchell talking a little 30 Rock. And then all kind of other things, Alabama governor's race, Florida governor's race, Arkansas Senate, Kentucky Senate. Going to cover a lot of topics. But I tell you what, the first thing I want to talk about, and it was mentioned a little as an aside in yesterday's Atlanta Constitution, but I think it's going to have a bigger impact on particularly the Republican primary in Georgia. Nathan Deal wants to try to blow life back into the birth certificate controversy, and I almost, you know, that needs air quotes because I don't know how much controversy there is to it. But he wants to, you know, have the president or the White House submit the birth certificate again to Congress, you know, bringing up this issue that pretty much only the very fringe of the Republican Party seems to be real concerned about. Tim, what do you make of this?
Oh, just pitiful. Pandering knows no boundaries, I suppose. Representative Deal's been running anywhere from 9 to 13% in the polls, and it looks like he might be beginning to panic just a little bit. One thing about the nail-spitting birthers and teabaggers and whoever he's trying to appeal to, they will vote in the Republican primary. He needs something to shake the race up. He doesn't even believe this. I've heard him say in the past, you know, how silly it was to question where the president was born. If he were to happen to somehow become the Republican nominee, he'd get beat over the head with this thing by everybody in the state, even his opponents. Karen Handel's campaign, Oxendine's campaign, they've all released statements pretty much ridiculing Representative Deal. And I really hate that he's done this.
Catherine, what do you think about it?
Well, I absolutely agree with him. It's a sign of desperation to me. You know, I guess he feels like it's an opportunity for him to get some attention, but I can't imagine that the people of Georgia are really interested in that kind of attention when we have this, you know, incredibly high unemployment rates. We have all these financial difficulties. We just were rated Atlanta was just rated the, you know, one of the most toxic cities in the United States. You know, we got a lot of other problems on our plate that I think we all want our future governor to be paying attention to, not this ridiculous you know, Swiss boat birthers stuff. It's crazy.
Yeah, I tell you what. I obviously, as a governing issue, I mean, it's just a total waste of time, a terrible move. I mean, I think if Nathan Deal wants to look at his career as a representative, I think he may even look back and see this one's a low point. But if he looks at himself as a candidate that wants to get any attention in the Republican primary, this is a great move. I mean, if that's what he really cares about. I sometimes think you have to wonder if you're so desperate to win something that you'll just do anything, is it really worth having? But, you know, he can't break out of these numbers. He's, you know, third most polls, probably could be fourth pretty quick if Eric Johnson solidifies some of the South Georgia vote. But if you look at some of the races, look what happened in the New York congressional race, which we'll get into later. Look at what Marco Rubio's doing in Florida. This kind of move will probably, you know, appeal to, in Georgia, probably a good third of the Republican primary voters. I mean, that's not a huge number of voters in, if you look at the general electorate, but in the primary, a third, you know, that may get him in the runoff, and that may be where he's saying, look, if I want to go anywhere in this race, I've got to win the primary. Now, of course, I agree with what Tim said early. If he then gets in the general election, this is going to be something that can pull voters out that might be hard to get out, that like they showed in Virginia, that, you know, Obama's popularity has not really dropped in Virginia, and we'll talk about that more later. It's just that some of the voters didn't come back out. Well,
right.
This is the kind of thing you can say, look, Nathan Deal, what he's doing, should he be the Republican nominee? Do y'all think, how much do you think this improves their odds, his odds of being that nominee? Catherine?
I can't imagine that it does, but I don't understand the world in which that works, but I'm sure that it does probably improve it in the world of the, you know, the Swift boat birth baggers for truth.
Tim, how much?
And I think you're right. There's a lot of them here. So
it might actually improve his chances for a little bit to slip in front of Karen Handel into second place and position himself to get into a runoff where then anything could happen. But the thing I keep getting back to, Representative Deal knows better than this. I've heard him say differently. He knows better than this. It's shameless pandering for votes. When is stuff like this going to start? Representative Deal, if you or anybody in your campaign's listening, you should be ashamed of yourself. That's just the way it is.
Yeah, I mean, it's just this echo chamber that has really got them. And they, you know, people say, oh, well, the Democrats with blogs, and it may be true at times. But there's this echo chamber where, you know, they watch Glenn Beck on Fox News and listen to Rush Limbaugh on radio, and it's just they embolden each other. And then it becomes, you know, who can one-up each other on the most right-wing positions. And, you know, the average voter that, you know, that votes Republicans and has kind of swung the pendulum over to the Republican side for Georgia, those voters aren't into this. But these hardcore Republican voters, I just think that there's some that, you know, are going to be swayed by this. And this may really help them get in a runoff, because I really don't see John Oxendine, Karen Handel, and certainly Eric Johnson of, you know, really closing this thing out, getting up to the 40s, 45%. There's just a ceiling on each one of them. So I think this really will help Deal, sadly enough, in the primary. Speaking of that campaign, I did see a straw poll that happened, I guess, in the past, or at least the results are reported in the last week, since we had our last show, and a southeastern Georgia county, and it actually showed Karen Handel doing a little better than, for instance, that Cobb County straw poll showed. And it's one straw poll, one county. I don't know how much that means, but I get the sense that maybe she may be upticking a bit. What do y'all think?
Oh, I don't get that, son.
Catherine?
I don't either.
Yeah, I don't see anything yet. You know, it's hard to say, and it's hard to, you know, it's kind of early to say, and, of course, we may be getting a lot less polling on this race because I don't know if y'all saw the report, but Strategic Vision, people are postulating that they may be kind of getting out of the polling business after people question their methodology, and so that was one of the main sources of Georgia polls. Catherine, any
I didn't hear about. I mean, I'm just learning about that now.
Yeah, with him.
Even the conservative bloggers that I've been reading are asking, where is Strategic Vision? Why aren't they saying anything? Why aren't they doing anything? What it does, David, is it makes it look like Nate Silver was right in his accusations that they doctored polls. It would be a shame to me if that did turn out to be true. But with Strategic Vision silent, well, let me ask you, what are we to think?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, they need to step up. I mean, I'll say this. I mean, they're not a polling firm. They're not a news firm. It was pretty much a door-opening service for their consulting, and I'm not really sure what kind of consulting they do. I guess I need to read those other parts of their website a little better. Seems like they're in a lot of areas. But if, let's say they can tell that expensive service of calling is not opening that many doors for them, then what's the point? I mean, what's the old Covey saying, where there's no margin, there's no mission?
Yeah.
For business model. Now, of course, then if it makes them look bad and people then suspect, oh, well, if they're not good pollsters, they're not good consultants, then that's another reason not to do it. But they do need to kind of come to some closure, tie a bow on it. So,
focusing on other, you know, portions of our business, because it looks like they do a lot of automobile stuff and media.
Yeah.
They
were going to do less polls. I mean, they did so many.
Yeah.
You know, if for instance, if it's just the look bad portion, now I guess if it's the money portion, then, you know, if something's losing you money, you stop doing it. I mean, that's kind of the model there. But then if it's like, well, it's not losing us that much money, it's opening some doors, just be a little more judicious. Pick certain races to do to get your attention. But I will say this, as far as the polling and particularly Southern polling goes, Strategic Vision, probably 2 years ago, was one of the best sources for getting them. But now public policy polling, Tom Jensen's group out of North Carolina, I find their information to be so much better and their analysis to be so much better. And they've kind of come on the scene in the last 2 years. So, honestly, if I had to make a one-for-one trade, I'd take that trade any day. What about y'all?
Well, yeah, that's an interesting thing. Public policy polling has really come out of nowhere really fast, haven't they? Again, let me not quote us because, yes, they are a Democratic firm. Let me go to the conservative blogosphere, who is saying, most of the conservative blogosphere, by the way, like Scott Rasmussen best, but to a person, the conservative bloggers are saying that they cannot argue with the accuracy of public policy polling in the national polls. And this is a little North Carolina firm that basically did North Carolina stuff, and all of a sudden, boom, here they come. The question is, how did they do so well on the national level so fast?
I think they put a lot of focus and time into it. And I don't. And even though, I get the sense they're more democratic, I think what they go at it almost more of from an academic standpoint. I mean, it's a little more cerebral seeming than some of the outfits that just want to get a top line number to throw out there to get some attention. I mean, and then the analysis they put out there for public consumption. I mean, you really, a lot of times, a number is one thing, but how somebody analyzes it can be so much more impressive and so much more interesting. So therefore, I think that's one thing that also sets them apart, is that those components. So, you know, it's just going to be interesting to see how this fleshes out. Well, I tell you what, even though we're probably going to just sprinkle this throughout the show, I think it's time to start breaking down the elections that were just this past Tuesday. And to me, one of the big bellwethers, I guess, for whatever reason, Tool pointed to Virginia. And I guess because it's so close to D.C., it was a state that went, you know, pretty sharply blue from being, you know, Republican so long, since like 1964, had always voted Republican. And then additionally, Tim Kaine, the head of the DNC, was leaving the governorship. But I had predicted that was going to be a single-digit race, close to 5 points. I love to crow when I'm right, but I'll have to admit when I'm wrong. What was it, an 18-point divide, if I'm not mistaken?
Yeah.
I was just dead wrong on that one. But Creed Deeds, you know, gosh, what can you say? I mean, he was lucky to get over 40. I mean, it was, you know, made the Taylor-Purdue race, you know, look a lot closer. Catherine, what do you take out of Virginia?
Well, you know, I at the beginning, or back when, you know, the primary was happening, I was kind of a fan of Deeds, but, boy, he just kind of sputtered out at the end there, and I think he was just not a very good candidate, and I don't think you can call that, you know, I don't think you can claim that the Democrats failed and that it's all Obama's fault and all that. Besides, historically, apparently, from what I've heard, I haven't looked at the numbers, but they say that the Virginia governor always goes the opposite of the White House. Like, it's like been for like the last 100 years or something. So, I mean, this wasn't unexpected.
Yeah, and you know, incumbency, I think, has a lot to do with that. But Tim, what's your thoughts?
Well, since 1973, Catherine, that's correct.
Oh, is that all?
Whichever party is in the White House has lost the Virginia governorship. It just looked to me like everything that could go wrong in this general election campaign did go wrong. I think, first of all, the Deeds campaign decided to run the wrong type of general election campaign. They decided to go negative immediately. They decided, for some reason, not to really reach out to the other two candidates that they beat in the Democratic primary, and most importantly, and I think the huge mistake, they decided to run away from the National Party and the president in particular. And frankly, Bob McDonnell was a better candidate than Creed Deeds was. He appealed to the voters better. He talked issues, and it just turned into the blowout that it was. And it happened at all levels. Now, how did I pick that last week, David? Do you recall?
Well, I mean, obviously, I think we all picked the winner. It was the spread.
I picked the 15-20-point win.
Well, there you have it.
I get the crow this week.
Yeah, and congratulations to you on that one.
Wish I'd have been wrong.
Yeah, I mean, I admit I was totally off on it. But I will say this. I don't think Terry McAuliffe or the other fella, Moran, would have really done that much better. I don't know. For whatever reason, it was just doomed from the beginning. And even though there was no incumbent running, I guess the Democratic Party was seen as the incumbent party. And I think if the Obama administration has to take any loss from this, I think it's the fact that he's an incumbent and it just wasn't a good year for incumbents. And I think we'll keep talking about this as we go through other, you know, races, particularly ones that have, I guess, some effect on economy. But it just was just not, I think that was part of it, even though Deeds, I guess, there was no direct secession line from, Tim Kaine in this. But I guess people saw that link and they thought, oh, it's just time for change. I am kind of surprised that McDonnell just didn't seem to be much of a moderate Republican, given all of his Liberty University roots.
Ran as one, though.
Yeah,
I guess. And
it doesn't
really
matter what he is, as long as what he runs for is.
But it seems like it would have come through. I mean, it came through to us, and when we got the information, and we're three states away. And
yeah, but you can't use us as examples.
No, I know. And here's the big thing I will take for this. I did see a poll, and I think it was actually Tom Jensen of Public Policy Bonds Analysis to boot, to give him a little more credit, like he needs it already on the show. But it showed that Obama's approval rating among voters that voted for him hadn't slipped a bit. His disapproval is pretty much where it was among McCain voters. What's different is the electorate looked different. Now, that is a little troubling sign, I guess, for the midterm, is if the electorate is a different composition than in 2008, some seats will be lost.
Right.
Then you'd have to be a case of that.
Well, that's why Tim Kaine's got to get on his ass and get the, you know, party motivated.
Yeah, but I will say this. Sometimes, I mean, there's just a burnout effect. Sometimes, you know, you can... This is the most important election. This is the most important election. I mean, how many elections have we heard John Lewis use that wonderful line, vote like you've never voted before?
That's
is it
okay.
Always the most important election?
We should always vote like we never voted before, but every election is just as important as the last.
Yeah,
whether it's your school board election or your city council election, your state legislative election, or your election for president, they're all equally important because they all have impact on your lives.
Well, exactly. To me, we ought to attack voting. Voting ought to be seen like church attendance or PTA meetings.
Well, that wouldn't work so well for me.
Well, but you see what I'm saying. Or like recycling. It's something that has to become habit. You do it every single time. It's not like this one's more important than that one.
I have a friend that says we should find people who don't vote.
But then we handle it. We handle it in campaign, and I think Democrats even more than Republicans. But Republicans do it too. We handle it like a football game. Oh man, this is the playoffs. This one's bigger. This one means more. And it ought to be you just show up and vote because it's the civic thing to do.
Well,
this is where I
have an issue with the way political parties are run, because they're run like campaigns, not like organizations that should be, you know, constantly building. I'm not just talking just about the Democratic Party of Georgia. All parties, they work on a campaign schedule instead of on a organizational building model.
Well, and particularly incumbents, because they know incumbents.
Well, no, I mean candidates. That's fine. Senators. Candidates do what they do, but
we're going to run every
the way candidates and parties run should be different, and they're not, because so many of our parties. And the Democratic Party of Georgia is a good example, are run by candidates or people who have run political campaigns, not organizations. You don't hear, the United Way saying, this is the most important donation, this is the most important year to make your donation. They want you to make your donation every year.
Yeah, I mean, that's
and they want you to increase it.
But we don't run
our parties like that. We run them like campaigns.
Yeah, this one's bigger than ever before. Yeah, and that's what I'm getting to. Tim, I'll give you the last thought on GOTV, and then we'll move to another race.
Well, it's simple. In midterm elections, historically now, the average voter is older and whiter. Well, right now, that is the base of the Republican Party. It might help them win an election or two, but the Republicans, David, are going to have to address this long-term issue of minority and young voters, because they're not getting them. I don't want anybody to read anything from 2010 into 2012, because I guarantee you, the minority and young voters, if they don't come out next year, they're definitely coming back out in 2012 to vote for President Obama.
Yeah,
but that's what's going on.
And final take-home stat I did see, McDonald won voters 18 to 30 in Virginia. So that tells you that younger voters that were more Democratic in 2008 just...
It tells you the scope of
his
win. When you win by 18 points, you're going to win about every demographic.
Yeah.
That says that demographic. I mean, people feel like Michael Dukakis won that demographic. So, you can win that demographic and you know, lose big time. But what happened there was those voters just didn't show back up. The ones that, I mean,
right.
the Liberty University crowd did, and people were complaining that, like, Liberty University gave the day off from classes. Heck, give everybody the day off. I have no problem with people having access to vote. That's why I love in Michigan they let unions, you know, have negotiated that as a day off. I'm for more Saturday elections like they do in Louisiana, things like that. But yeah, and let's go ahead while we're on it, we'll talk about another big Republican win. I think this one was actually bigger. It's not the South, but it's just too big with so few elections not to talk about. New Jersey, John Corzine, incumbent Democratic governor, lost to a candidate that he was down to, had taken the lead back from, and then he lost it in the end by about 4 points. I don't think we predicted that one. Lucky for me, because I'd have probably picked Corzine by four, knowing the way I was trending. But, Tim, your thoughts on this?
Well, what you have was a governor with his approval rating in the 30s. He was getting killed by double digits back in the summer. So what his campaign decided to do was to come out with the chainsaws and drag Christie's approval ratings down because he could not lift his own approval ratings up. It almost worked. There was a third-party candidate in the race who was polling in the double digits the whole time, but on election day, as third-party candidates tend to fade, he only got 6% of the vote. I guess a lot of voters said, well, I'm not going to throw my vote away on this guy that voted for Christie. Christie got 49% of the vote and beat an unpopular governor in a state that has in the past, you know, elected some Republican governors, even though they haven't elected anybody statewide. The exit polling, David, showed the top two issues were the economy, which, of course, is in the tank in New Jersey, and property taxes, which are amongst the highest in the country. Both of those things, you know, dead against Governor Corzine. So, and looking back, it's not really a surprise that he lost there.
Okay,
no, it's not a surprise. He was, like, the easiest guy to dislike of all the Democratic governors.
That's
true. You know, he was always, like, kind of full of himself. I noticed today in the news that he's vacationing in the Caribbean now, so more power to him.
Tough life, huh?
Well, I mean, my goodness, I'd go campaign, too, after our campaign.
And you know, David, he was also the former CEO of Goldman Sachs.
Exactly. He was the easiest guy to dislike.
I don't think that endeared him to the voters up there.
Well, you know, he always seemed to have to win his elections by just absolutely spending with an avalanche of cash. I mean, not just a little bit outspending, but I mean crazy amounts, you know, like $60 million in the first election.
Reminds you of the mayor's race in New York, doesn't it?
Yeah,
which we'll get there soon enough. But I'll tell you, and speaking of that negative campaigning that he did, it reminded me kind of how Gray Davis won that second term that lasted, what, for a year? I mean, he just absolutely went negative on his opponent and eked out a victory in a even year. So I guess maybe the take-home question on New Jersey, if this would have been an even year election, would Corzine have pulled it out? Catherine?
I don't think so. I think he was just too easy to dislike. It was hard for people to vote for him. I mean, I know he got, whatever, you know, 44 or 45, but...
Yeah. Tim?
Even numbered year, if it was next year, yeah, he'd have won. Just because more voters would have come out to the polls, and the voters stay home tend to be more Democratic.
Yeah, and that's my sneaking suspicion, too, that he would have pulled that out in an even numbered year. I mean,
with all that money, he should have been able to do some GOTV.
And then obviously, I mean, you probably had a good percentage of voters that voted for him 4 years ago. We voted for him for Senate, you know, back when he first won in the Senate, and didn't support him this time. I mean, I'll be honest. I tell you what, if I had a Senate seat, I just don't know that I'd want a gubernatorial seat. I mean, even in the economy.
I think the Senate is the best job in the world. I do.
Yeah.
I think it's better than the presidency.
Yeah.
I mean, that's some serious power there.
Well, I mean, I mean, the presidency, my goodness, you're leader of the free world. You're a list of 44 other people. Actually, probably less than that because the way they count Grover Cleveland. But I mean, it's just as far as the governorship, a lot of times people say, oh, the three leaders of the party, the three leaders of the state, two senators and the governor. And the governor, particularly in this bad economy, I guess maybe a true leader should say, I want to attack the problems and make things better. But I think the economy's become not only nationalized but internationalized to the point where sometimes you probably can't even make a difference in a huge way sometimes for your state. So that's just my thought on that. Well, New York, this is one election that told me it was a bad year for incumbents because Michael Bloomberg, who seems to be relatively popular, nobody's saying that he's done a bad job, that much. The crime rate has stayed real low, and he hadn't had to use some of the heavy-handed tactics of Giuliani. You would think, okay, I don't even think he drew a top-flight opponent, but he won by like single digits, kind of underwhelming win, and he was an incumbent. Tim, your thoughts on New York City?
Yeah, well, first of all, Democrats, registered Democrats outnumber registered Republicans, and that says something like, 3-4-1,
yeah,
maybe more. Secondly, Bloomberg left the Republican Party and ran for re-election as an independent, which didn't exactly endear him to those registered Republicans that I just mentioned, who I think a lot of them decided to sit on their hands here. But the funny thing is the polls never showed this, David. It showed him with big double-digit lead right up to Election Day, and he won the thing by 5 points, and he spent $100 million of his own money. But I really think what hurt him in this particular case was leaving the Republican Party and running as an independent.
Yeah, I mean, that probably caused some of those folks to, stay home. But you would just think maybe the independent might make some more Democrats say, oh, it's okay to support him. But it just was, to me it fit with that incumbency theme. And then the last race, to me, that we're going to talk about at least for the national picture, because we're going to, of course, get to the Atlanta mayor's race, which I don't think had anything to do with the national picture, my personal opinion there, New York 23. This long-held Republican seat, pretty much the way you look at it, I guess, if you look at its current configuration, never been Democratic. It became in play, and we've talked about this before, how the conservative candidate basically pushed the Republican candidate out. Republican candidate endorses the Democratic candidate, but I had a sneaking feeling that the conservative candidate would win the thing, but no. The Democratic candidate wins the race, and basically to me then makes, who won the night a toss-up, because this is the only legislative race that actually directly impacts national policy, not state policy. Catherine, what's your assessment of it?
Well, I was surprised. I really didn't expect it, and I was very pleasantly surprised, of course. And this guy seems like a pretty cool guy. I mean, for Northern, almost Canada, Northern New York. And I think that the, Hoffman was just kind of a little bit crazy. Like, I read a little bit about him. He was just kind of a nut, and I think people recognized it.
Yeah, but he was so nutty that a bunch of the GOP heavyweights endorsed him, and he was able to push the true Republican candidate out of the race.
Well, that's a lesson they should learn. That when you push the moderate Republican out of the race, you're going to lose.
Yeah, particularly in a state like New York. I mean,
well, that part of New York is very conservative, though.
Yeah, I tell you, I drove through that part of the. I didn't realize it at the time, but I mean, I drove through that entire district. I think I probably my family coming back from Montreal probably did as good a tour as some of the candidates did in one day. of that district, and it is very rural. But I tell you one thing. I saw more wind power in that district than I've seen in any other place in America I've been through. They had so many windmills on their hills using wind power. And you got to think, I mean, you know, if you're using that type of source of energy into that, you know, you're probably not one of the flat earthers that doesn't believe in global warming. And
oh, I don't know. A lot of the people who do that just don't want to pay the utilities. My father was from that part of New York, from way up north in northern New York, and it is a like you said, it's very rural. It's very there's a real pioneering spirit up there. It's a lot like northern Canada. You know, it's very sparsely populated and lots of snow in the winter.
Yeah.
Anyway, I was happy. I mean, I'm pleased as punch that we got that seat.
Yeah, Tim, what do you think on New York 23?
Well, I saw Hoffman, the conservative candidate, speak, and I'm going to put it charitably, the guy was an empty suit. There was one problem with him. Another problem with him was he did not live in the district. He lived 20 miles outside the district. What was the name of that little town where they had the 1980 Winter Olympics? That's where he lived. So that coupled with the fact that all these huge outside interests like the Club for Growth and Rush Limbaugh and Beck and Sarah Palin was piling into this district and basically pushing the Republican candidate out of the way that had been chosen by the county chair, it made Hoffman look like an interloper. Now, the baseline for Democrats running for Congress in the last few years there has been 36%. So that's where Owen started. The Republican candidate, she was sitting at about 20% in the polls when she pulled out and endorsed him. She got 6% on election night. That coupled with the moderates that went over and voted for Owens was just enough to put him over the top. And I'm with Catherine. I hope the Republicans took note of this and learned a lesson. But it looks to me, David, like they're going to repeat the same mistake, at least down there in Florida next year.
Yeah, I think it's purity. I think, and here it is. Are there some Republicans that learned a lesson? Sure, they get it. But there's so many more that just would rather be pure on every issue. And
hey,
purity,
that's fine.
That's fine
for me as a Democrat.
You know, I mean, when you basically want to purge your party of moderates like Lindsey Graham, I mean, we talked about this because they want to say an unkind word about Glenn Beck and his nonsense. That's not even a substantive argument. That's just, you know, pyrrhic victories. And, you know, James Carville in one of his books talked about winning pyrrhic victories. I mean, this is going to be a party that seems to be real interested in those if they continue down this path. But I guess the last election that was really in our sights, because we didn't talk about races like Charlotte mayor, was the Atlanta mayor's race. And pretty interesting to me how it turned out. There will be a runoff. Mary Norwood will face Kasim Reed. And what I found so striking is Mary Norwood basically held what she's had for a long time in the polls, but almost added no votes to it. And then Kasim Reed seemed to suck up every undecided vote and siphoned off a good many of Lisa Borders supporters. Catherine, you being the Atlanta resident, how did you see it?
Exactly the same way you did. I have to say that I was flabbergasted by the number that Lisa got. I was absolutely flabbergasted. It was like 14.5%. She didn't even get 12,000 votes. But the more important, big picture on this recent election, 24% of the registered voters voted. Fewer than 70,000 people voted in that race for the mayor of Atlanta. Mm. And we have a runoff now. If we're very lucky, will get 50% of those voters back out. And that's really lucky. So that's 35,000 people deciding who the mayor is for what most people consider the most important city in the Southeast. That's just shocking to me. And
yeah,
in Shirley's second race, where she really didn't even have a opponent, 41% voted. So it's a pretty sad state of affairs, if you ask me. I was pretty disgusted by it myself.
And it was good weather.
Oh, it was beautiful.
Yeah, your thoughts.
Well, Catherine, I wanted to ask you a question here. It had seemed to me in recent weeks as if the air had just gone out of Lisa Borders' campaign. What happened to her?
I don't know exactly what happened. I wasn't inside baseball with that campaign, but I have to agree with you. There was, there was a pretty good analysis in the Creative Loafing the day after the election, and I think that we all kind of understood where Mary Norwood was coming from. She was she wanted to be the change agent. You know, she wanted something new and different, and she was gonna, she'd spent a lot of time in the individual neighborhoods around the city, and that was her thing. You know, she was listening to the people, and that was kind of her thing. Even though she'd been in the city council for a long time, she was going to be, bring a new spirit to the city hall. Kasim Reed was sort of the outsider, even though he, ran Mayor Franklin's campaigns. He was the outsider. He's been in the state legislature, but he lives in the city, and he was raised in the city. So everyone kind of knew where he was coming from. He was a legislator, and he had, a lot of the tried and true support of the African-American and progressive community in Atlanta. But no one really understood where Lisa was coming from. She never really staked a claim on anything specific. I never really understood, who is she? What's her passion? I mean, she talked about being, she was passionate about Atlanta, but I don't think anyone really understood what it was. And actually, some things came out later after the election. She was a big supporter of microloans for small business, which is a really kind of innovative idea, and nobody even knew it. I didn't know it. I'm a big supporter of microloans as well. Small $5,000 to $10,000 loans to help small businesses get started, but no one knew that. She was a big supporter of it, and we found out after the fact that was the case. So I think that she had a hard time sort of staking her territory.
Hmm. Well, that's a very good analysis, by the way.
Well, I got that from Creative Loafing. But I think it's spot on. I really do. I think, and the other thing about Lisa, and this is going to sound really snarky, but she's a very attractive woman. I've met her in person. I've talked to her at length. But she never really looked that good on television or in the newspaper, and I don't know what that means. I was kind of surprised by that. Like, she always had on the red power suit, and that was it. She didn't have a lot of panache. She didn't have a lot of style. Whereas Kasim, he wears a really sharp suit and is very when he's on, he's very friendly and talkative, and I think she looked a little stiff. I don't know how much of an impact that has, but every little bit makes a difference in these races.
Yeah, I'll tell you, I think it was two things on Lisa Borders. One, I think there's a song, "If Your Heart Isn't In It, Why Don't You Just Let Me Go." I just don't think her heart was in the campaign, and I think it shows.
Why?
Secondly, I think she wanted to serve, but she didn't want to run, and we've talked about this again, so I don't want to belabor the point, but I think that's a big part of it. Secondly, I think if you look at the campaign managers and consultant teams, I just think that Kasim Reed, I believe he was playing with an A-team You know, Mary Norwood, probably an A-minus team, you know, real close. I mean, some really top-notch folks on both teams. You know, both of them had ties to President Obama's. I think Axelrod's group was, you know, clearly running the media for the president's campaign, and that's who ran Kasim Reeds. But then Murphy Putnam, you know, that they worked with Bill Richardson, and I think then later tied in and did some support ads. So, and then, you know, the campaign managers, I think we've talked about this before. Theron Johnson worked for John Barrow. Roman Levitt worked for John Barrow. One was the campaign manager, one the deputy campaign manager. And they're the campaign managers for those two other two campaigns. Lisa Borders had a state rep that she, you know, kind of changed up, reshuffled the deck with a little bit to go. And, you know, state reps, they know politics to a point, but they're usually so busy being the candidate, they're not the coach, if you will. They're not the manager, so that just wasn't a good fit. And so I think all those factors played into it.
Well, I think the other part of it is that Mary Norwood has been running for mayor since, 2006. Seriously. I mean, she's been running for mayor for a long time.
Yeah.
Kasim, I think, of course, he couldn't really run during the legislative session, but he's been laying the groundwork for a long time.
Yes.
And, you know, we all sort of knew he was going to run even 2 years ago. So I think that, but Lisa, I think everybody kind of expected her to run. But then when she pulled out and came back in, I think that she lost her footing. And people lost their confidence in her. I mean, I've talked to a lot of people who were Lisa Borders supporters before she left the race. But when she left the race, they went over to Kasim or to Mary or to Jesse Spikes, or they just, you know, lost interest. And then when she came back in, it was hard. It's hard to, so if you've gone to another candidate and made a commitment, it's difficult to say, well, wait a minute, you know, Lisa's back in. You know, you don't really do that. I mean, most of us who are loyal Democrats, you know, we have loyalty is important to us. And if you make a commitment, you make a commitment. And so I think that contributed to her, but those results were really pretty shocking.
Yeah, and I wonder now as we get to the runoff, looking at the next step, you know, where we go for here in general. But then second, the Democratic Party of Georgia, we talked about it extensively last week. Do they stay involved in this race? Tim, what do you think?
Boy, I hope not. Good grief, did they look silly injecting themselves into that race in that fashion. And you know what? I don't think it made that much difference on election night. So what do they have to gain by doing this, David?
Nothing.
That's my question to y'all. What do they have to gain by this?
I think they have a lot to risk. I don't think I don't know what the motivation is, and I hope one day we find out, even if we don't share it on the air, we just find out to find out since we're all three stakeholders in the party. But I will say this. I do think there was some effectiveness to it because, I mean, if you would have to think if you look at an undecided electorate that the votes get split in some fashion where each of the candidates get some. And Mary Norwood, like we said before, she didn't get any. So something held her down from adding to her base. And I have to think that this may have been part of it. If nothing else, her commercials were having to respond to this, in which still, unfathomably, I still don't understand why she said, I went to the Republican convention and I didn't like it. I mean, if nothing else, it got her off message to then gain at least, 5-10% of the undecided. Because even if she didn't win the thing outright and get 50, if she got somewhere close to 50, it'd be like, okay, this thing's a foregone conclusion. I think this race is close to 50-50 as far as if everybody comes back or you can add to who didn't come back. But as far as the runoff, does one candidate or the other have an advantage in which one of their bases is more likely to come out? Catherine, any ideas?
Well, the general assumption is that Mary has an advantage because that people think that her people will come back out, and that Kasim's people won't. I don't know. I don't think that's true. I mean, just being here in Atlanta, visibility, Kasim is everywhere still. every street corner on the way to work all week, every street corner. So I think he recognizes that, his team recognizes that they've got to really push the electorate out to get him elected. And he's got some pretty smart people working for him, not just as in management, but in field. And so I think...
Catherine, you did a great job of ignoring the 800-pound elephant in the room, alluding to Mike Lukovich's cartoon.
Oh, I didn't see that.
You didn't see that, okay. But her people and his people. It was a giant elephant. It has Mary Norwood and Kasim Reed drawings, both looking forward, smiling. And the big elephant in the room, of course, that has to do with party with that. And then also it has race written on the elephant. And it says, the one that wins mayor will be the one that does the best job ignoring the 800-pound elephant in the room.
Some question about what Lisa will do. If she'll, I don't know if she made an announcement, but there was some, talk that she was going to, support somebody.
I'll tell you this. I'd rather have her endorsement than not have it. But I wouldn't lose any sleep over if I didn't have it.
Do you think your voters won't come back out regardless?
Might not follow her lead.
Yeah.
But I tell you what, if somebody has a trick to get at these voters that didn't show up, that typically do show up for elections, now that may be the trick. If you could somehow figure out who those voters are more likely to support and somehow figure out how to galvanize all those voters to come back, because it sounds like the voters that came out, those 70,000 people, are probably going to come out back anyway. And so you don't have to worry as much about them. It's getting those voters that showed up in 2008, showed up in, 2005, certainly, in that reelection campaign you're talking about, Catherine. If those voters, you could get them out, that might do you a big help.
You think that the voters that came out last week are going to all come back out?
Not all, but I think if there are those voters that vote because it's civic habit, then you don't have to worry about as much. If y'all seen the four quadrants, the voters that are for you and come out no matter what, the voters that are against you and come out no matter what, and then there's the other two categories, the voters that don't necessarily come out but are with you and the ones that don't necessarily come out and are against you. And that's some six quadrant ones. But what you do is the ones that you always come out that you know are for you, you don't mess with. Of course, poke the snake pit either, the ones that are against you. But you've got to get those voters out that are with you but don't necessarily get out easy.
Yeah.
That's the trick. And that's what I'm saying. If you can figure out who those voters are, which ones they are, and get them out, because they can still vote in the runoff. Which we could argue, should that rule should be changed?
I think that the solution is that we should get rid of the runoffs and have instant runoff voting on election day.
Yeah, and it'd be interesting to see who would have won that. Well, I tell you what, we've got about 5 minutes, and we've got a lot of topics we hadn't talked about. And for those of you that want to talk about 30 Rock and politics, I'm just going to leave that alone since our guest has not come in yet, and I've been watching that switchboard. I'm sure y'all have too. But I'm going to pick Kentucky Senate. That's one we don't talk about much. And, this race has unfolded. You have the sitting senator, Jim Bunning. It looked like he may have run, and Trey Grayson jumped in the race, and he was going to run to secede. And go ahead and beat Jim Bunning outright in the primary, and he looked like he was poised to do that. And Jim Bunning decided not to run, and it looked like he was going to be anointed the Republican nominee. But a Rand Paul, who was a Paul Republican of Ron Paul fame, is jumped in the race, and he has jumped into the lead. He was nine down, and now he's three up in the primary for Kentucky Republican Senate. What do you think about this, Tim, about this Ron Paul conservative?
Well, I'm a little shocked at this poll, first of all. Grayson has been ahead in all other polling that I've seen, so I'd like to see another poll or two to confirm this. That being said, if Rand Paul is the nominee, Man, I think the Democrats can win that Senate seat. Because Grayson, you know, has been running ahead of the Democrats, well ahead of the Democrats. Not so with Paul in the general election matchups. If he's the nominee, we can win this thing.
Yeah, there's actually another poll release that shows that head-to-head matchups, you're absolutely right. Grayson's a stronger general election candidate.
Right.
But, and this is a different fringe movement than the flaggers and the birthers and all these characters. These Ron Paul people are a whole different deal, and this is not the only race this crew's getting interjected in. I forget the other race that I believe it may be a Georgia congressional race that they're interjecting themselves in, so this could be a new wrinkle. Catherine, what's your thoughts?
Well, I didn't realize that Ron Paul had children that were going to run for office. Jesus, who let him have children?
Well, Catherine, you know, the Kennedy
children. I know, it's easier to, it's harder to adopt a cat than to have a child. Well, I tend to agree with Tim. I think if he's the nominee, the Democrats take it.
Yeah, I mean that's what the polls are showing. That, slip of the tongue, and I tell you on the Democratic side, it's so funny and this race has closed in. Well, actually, it hadn't closed in much. It's about the same, but the lieutenant governor stays ahead of the attorney general, both Democrats in the Democratic primary. But if you look general election wise, Jack Conway, the attorney general, is a much stronger candidate. It seems like the other E, you know, in Democratic politics, it's the economy, education, environment, but the fourth E, electability, ought to come in this thing pretty soon.
Yeah.
Tim, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, it will come into play, and I think it's going to come into play on the Republican side, too. What's going on the Democratic side is the more moderate voters tend to shy away from the lieutenant governor and toward Conway, I believe his name is. And in the, you know, the general election voter is a different animal altogether. And I think even on the Republican side, they're gonna take a second look at this. Maybe Paul is doing so well on the name recognition of his father.
Yeah, I mean, and I just, we'll get to see it. I know we talked about it the other week about the mind of the conservatives poll, but I think it comes to play more and more, you know, these hardcore folks that show up in the 22% of the electorate elections have a bigger influence.
But the conservative, I mean, the Kentucky Republican voter is pretty conservative, as conservatives go. It doesn't seem to me like Rand Paul would appeal to them, would they?
But think about how well, like, even that, remember the fellow we had on that ran for South Carolina Senate as a Democrat, that flat-top Bob? And he was a Rand Paul guy, and somehow he got his people into the Democratic primary to win that thing.
Right.
I mean, you got to think, that's a whole lot harder to win a Democratic primary as a Ron Paul guy than it is the Republican primary. And they were able to do that in South Carolina. Why couldn't they figure out how to do it in Kentucky? So it'll be another one to watch. But guys, I tell you what, it's been a good show, been a lot of analysis and a lot of topics, and we just, you know, left a lot on the table that hopefully we can get back to next week. But until then.
Thanks, guys.
Good night.
Good night.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.